Hello, I'm John Waters, and I'm supposed to announce there is no smoking in this theater, which I think is one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard of in my life. How can anyone sit through a length of a film, and especially a European film, and not have a cigarette? But don't you wish you had one right now? And I'm telling you, smoke anyway. It gives ushers jobs. And if people didn't smoke, there would be no employment for the youth of today. So once again, no smoking in this theater.
All right, here's what I got. Here's the drink situation, okay? Because this might cause issues, and I want to get it. So I got a mug, right? Mug full of coffee. I'm drinking it. It's good. It's what you're supposed to do, right? Okay. I don't want to, because I'm a professional, I don't want to have to leave the office that I'm recording in order to go get more coffee halfway through, right? What kind of sicko would ever leave a podcast halfway through, say, in order to go do something like that or use the bathroom or anything like that, right? So here's what I've got. I've got a Yeti mug, company branded, that has hot coffee that I'm going to attempt to pour into my mug. You know, you might think, why not just drink it out of the mug? No, because the Yeti, I don't know if you guys got Yetis, but like if that shit's hot in there, that shit stays hot for a long time. You can do that where you crack the lid.
Yeah.
It doesn't really.
Yeti's.
It's too effective.
Yeti is baby's first thermal mug, though. Like, to be honest, I have much better ones. Weeks on, it'll still be at least lukewarm. Promise. But my question is, why aren't you just drinking it straight from. You said straight from the mug. Like, you're pouring it? How does this help you during the recording?
Because it is.
You know, I was about to make a joke that was like, oh, I'm sorry, Aaron, that was too complex. Could you slow down and explain it for me again? But I guess I don't need Jason to make that joke now because Jason has questions.
I disagree with your assessment of the Yeti being like the, you know, like, yes, for your case where you are cosplaying as a person who goes out into the woods and lives amongst the bears. Yes, you might need a fucking big ass, but I am a fucking humble podcaster / guy playing video games.
That's
on
an
Sunday
oxymoron,
morning.
But
I do
continue.
Not need a giant fucking, you know, lunch pail, a fucking thermos. And I will say, before Yetis came around, this shit sucked because every single time I would Google, like, what's a good thermos for, you know, coffee? What's a good, the same thing would always come up. It would be the Zoji Rushi, which is generally a good brand, but it'd be the Zoji Rushi, like stainless steel. If you like Google Zoji Rushi, it's all like the same, like very cylindrical, thin, kind of like, you know, the same. It doesn't like, you know, deviate or kind of splay out at all. And those things keep your shit so fucking hot that it is impossible to use them for anything except like bringing something to work, like pouring coffee in them just for like sitting around during the day. Impossible. You burn your shit every single time. Yeti has perfected the art of like big mouth, so if you do kind of crack it, it will cool down. Where like the Zoji Rushi is like so thin at the top that the heat dissipation, even if you open the lid, was just like nothing.
I mean, have you tried the brown rice setting?
No. Okay. So again, good brand. Their rice cookers, as I understand, are, you know, great. But anyway,
T-O-T-L, that's my rice cooker,
thermos.
T-B-H.
Yetis, as much as they're like kind of the, ooh, everybody has a Yeti, they're good. Like they really do what they say.
You know,
I'd
love to clown on this, but I actually totally agree with that point. Unfortunately,
it's like the perfection of that.
I just like, I want a thermos that,
yes,
just sort of like lets it cool down a little bit. Like if I could control it myself, yes, that would be ideal.
If
but
Harry
this is,
and I were sitting on like a giant steel girder on a skyscraper and we were just like sitting, eating sandwiches and we finally unpacked the coffee from 19 hours ago when we had our last break, then yes, then we would maybe need something a little better. But we're humble.
I mean,
I
think your delivery mechanism needs work. If you're slurping it down to where it hurts when it's hot, you have like the wrong delivery mechanism. Like I have an old Stanley before they were cool.
That's not the method.
It's like
you're supposed
it's
to
one
use,
of those.
Jason,
it's one of those very cylindrical, very straight top. It doesn't bezel or like you know, funnel. It's just straight up and down cylindrical. You might have seen it, and it's got this little button that opens the drinking hole, and it just lets out just enough to where it's like, oh, that's a pleasant. If you aspirate it on the way in. pleasant amount of heat no matter when you drink it. And then I've got a little tiny one by a brand called Fellow, sponsors of this podcast, that is, that has this like little metal thing that prevents splashing when you tip it. It's like, don't pretend like just because you have it, it's the best version of the thing.
No, that's the other thing about Yetis, is it is there is the cup and there's the lid. There's not some bullshit third piece you got to fucking walk. There's not. I don't want that. There's a lid.
I'm actually with you
on
this point as well. Yeah, I hate.
Yeah, I know.
Fucking lines.
Like the little like the, weird filtration system.
Oh, I hate to agree with Aaron. Yeah, I'm right on shit, motherfucker. You know, like what do you want me to say?
Not, when he's right, folks. You know. Yeah. Also, I feel like I'm experiencing in real time what it's like to be our listeners right now. Just hearing Jason explain, oh, yeah, my thermos has a little cap that I can press up and down to make it open in like 30,000 words and making it sound like it was nuclear fission or something. It was like, wait, I think I understand what he's trying to describe right now, but I'm honestly getting a little lost.
Very similar to us discussing most movies that
right.
we talk
no,
about
exactly.
in a weird way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's why our good, kind listeners can press the button that says the episode actually starts at around whatever this will be, 6 minutes or so. Check that out in the show notes or just hit the little next chapter button in your player, listener, as we dive into an episode about a story in which you might, like if you were one of the people in this movie, you might need a thermos that keeps your coffee very hot for very long. Thank you very much for listening to Trial Love. It's a literal roundtable podcast where we talk about movies we saw or people we met at the Trial and Cinema in Minneapolis, Minnesota. You can find us on Twitter at Trial Love Podcast, find the Trial On at Trial and Cinema and at trialon.org. My name is Jason Daphnis and I like a nice loud voice. You can find me on Twitter at Nintendoofus.
Hey, can you guys help me? I'm trying to get where I need to go. It's 3 p.m. and I have physics with the physical sister. I'm Cody Narvison and you can find me on Blue Sky at Cody Narvison.
Lots of people are trying to have physics with the physical sister in this movie, if you know what I mean. May I congratulate you?
That's the
you
joke
about-
already. Yeah. Sorry, continue.
Wow. We should just end the podcast, honestly. Well, I want to congratulate you about the birth of Jesus Christ. I'm Harry Mack, and you can find me on Twitter at PunishTake.
Would you like to interrupt me during my quote as like a, you know what I mean? Like a
no, I think that would be really
situation.
Rude. And you're right. Not very nice thing to do. I'm
going
to do it
Aaron.
Anyway, though. Hey, what's up?
There we go. My name is Aaron, and I'm going to give up being clever and famous. And you can find me on Twitter at RBPlease.
Check out
it
this
was really
movie.
It was really hard to choose, by the way. There were a lot of fucking quotes in this movie that would work really well.
Bangers all.
Well,
this
it's like
movie,
James Bond level fucking innuendos without being, you know, pussy galore. It's like that close. You know what I mean?
Sausages. That's all I'll say. This movie played as part of the Two by the Archers, I believe, at the Trial-On in March. You can check out other programming at the Trial-On at trialon.org. But I'm not going to say another word about the movie, as we've said so many, before our own Aaron Grossman gives us the patented Aaron Grossman summary, which he always kicks off with his key catchphrase.
Yes, indeed, folks. Thanks, Jason. We are talking about Black Narcissus, 1947 film, directed by Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger, duo, based on the 1939 novel of the same name by Rumer Godden. The film follows a group of Anglican nuns who travel to an old palace overlooking the town of Mopu in the Himalayas. Gifted the palace by the local Indian ruler, they set up a school and a hospital, but run into significant trouble when kind of a combination of the attitudes of the local people, the nature of the environment, literally and not around them, and the presence of a attractive young British man conflicts with their kind of repressed way of life and start causing kind of tensions to rise. The film stars Deborah Kerr, Kathleen Byron, Flora Robson, Jenny Laird, and Judith Firth as the group of nuns. Sabu is the general's heir, referred to in the film as the young general. David Farrar is the hot young British piece of ass, Mr. Dean, and Gene Simmons as Conchi, a young local woman. Although Rumer Godden, the author of the novel, disliked the film on release for reasons we might talk about, it was critically acclaimed. It would go on to win two Academy Awards for Best Color Cinematography and Best Color Art Direction back when they still kind of you know, separated those things. The film has gone on to be considered one of the greatest ever made, with particular praise being given to its use of kind of these beautiful matte paintings for backgrounds of the mountains and the valleys and whatnot. That's what I got.
Boy, Mr. Farrar, that's just a whore, right?
That's, dude, he's sluttier than any human being he has really ever is. Dressed in this movie.
Short shorts
rules.
And the fucking...
I kept,
yeah.
Every time I saw him, I was like, God damn, I gotta start dressing.
With there's his, a like, bunch of scenes where he's standing around like a bunch of nuns who are like all wearing like white, you know, like, are they vestments? I guess call them fucking vestments.
Sure.
They're vestments, right? And they're just like standing around, you know, hands folded. And he's just like shirt open, sometimes no shirt. Always wearing these little shorts. It's like, put on a fucking shirt, dude.
Like, one-inch inseam shorts. My man, like, invented the short short.
While all these, like, the nuns, we never, almost never see their, like, on their introductions, we almost never see their faces first. It's always, like, the back of their habits or, like, in three-quarter glance or whatever. With him, literally, like, the first thing you see is the underside of his ball sack. It's like that sweater that Cody got me that I found when I was a kid in Greece. That's, like, why I can't wear shorts and one of them's just hanging out. That's what he's wearing throughout this entire movie. And they put him on a comically small pony just to make him look like he's riding something roughly, you know, in the size of a human. It's nuts. It's just wildly.
It's like
overt.
I really loved in Wikipedia. They describe him as virile, and I think like that word was invented for this character. It's like this is like virility is that dude, right? It's like exactly what I always picture when I think of that word.
The immediate association is strong, and I also want to see the Wikipedia entry and see if there's like a little citation needed on virile.
What is the How do you get hair product like that in the Himalayas? You know what I mean? Like, do you think he packed cartons of Dapper Dan? You know what I mean? Like, what did he do in order
to get
the
It'll look like the end of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, where the house floods and all the Dapper Dan just goes flying out all over the valley because there are so many used packages of it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's in his closet at his little shack that we see one scene in. Yeah.
So I went into this movie with pretty much all of the nuance of the way that we started this episode is just like it is repression, it is nuns who are sort of like denying and succumbing to in various degrees their desires outside of the convent, outside of the order, after being put in a new position, a new place. I have read this movie described as, specifically through the Perisphere blog, a piece by Sophie Durbin called Why Black Narcissus is a haunted house movie, as obviously haunted. It's very easy to pick up on horror vibes, but as specifically haunted house because the location is often credited with being a like an influence on these women. It's the culture, it's the exoticism, it's the new people. Even I think it's Sister Philippa says the exact phrase: "It's this place with its strange atmosphere and new people." How do we feel about that comparison to haunted house vibes? To like the place is what's affecting people, because that seems to be a pretty common thread of like, oh, you're missing the point type. Criticism of this movie is like that, or at least in my view, I read a couple of reviews where people were sort of down on the movie because it does have that air of like fetishizing or othering, so to speak, the location in which these nuns are operating, because it's sort of like impacting them a certain way and they're just not able to assimilate, and you know, it's sort of rejecting them sort of thing, and that's, you know, got its own implications, troubles, and problematic nature. So how do we feel about that response? How do you sort of like interpret that and ingest that?
I mean, it's kind of it's interesting, and I think there's like multiple different aspects of it, right? I think that like one thing, you know, I mentioned that the author of the book that this novel like follows pretty closely. I think that this movie is like generally considered a pretty faithful adaptation of the book by Rumor Godden. She disliked the movie when it came out because she thought that it was, you know, this kind of overly fantastical, you know, specifically like a lot of the stuff that is now, you know, kind of widely acclaimed, like the backgrounds and whatnot, and the kind of melodramatic nature of these character conflicts and whatnot. You know, it is kind of overly heightened from like an emotional perspective, purposefully in the film. She viewed it as like not really realistic, like, yeah, again, overly melodramatic. And she like disliked those aspects of the film. I think that, you know, it is like, you know, kind of funny that those are the things that have like gone on to like endure like past 1947 or so. Right. I think that, you know, for me, It is a little tricky to talk about because this film is like, you know, reading this through a lens of like Orientalism, like this is what this film is doing, right? I think that like with any sort of Orientalist text or text that is purposefully using Orientalism, which I think this movie is doing to a certain degree that we can maybe talk about.
It's going to be interesting to talk about that, right? Because it's like it is and it isn't in some ways.
Right. There's also, you know, a bunch of, you know, brown face in this film. We'll get to it. Not to like hand-wring about that stuff, but I think for like any time you have like a movie that has those elements or a story that has those elements, I think there is the nature in which like, you know, that sort of stuff like speaks to, you know, the kind of the time and the place in which the movie was made. But I also think that like this film as a film that is concerned with Orientalism and is, you know, can be viewed through that lens is also an interesting mirror for the characters in it. Right. And like, yes, you know, they didn't shoot this on location. And I think that it would be totally fair for someone to, you know, critique the film in that manner. But I also think that like the nature of this film using these kind of, you know, this kind of set and then having these clearly fake, but like, you know, a super kind of fantastical backgrounds, I think kind of highlights what the film is doing. And I think that like that contradiction is not something that like undercuts any of that. That contradiction is like inherent to Orientalism in general, right?
Well said.
That contradiction is like one of the key components. It is traveling to a place, trying to understand a place, eventually coming away from it completely like confused, right? While also not ever actually being immersed in that culture or understanding that culture. That contradiction is like the thing, I think, right?
Yeah, it's a real like Heart of Darkness situation, right? Where it's like the criticism of Heart of Darkness, which is a more egregious example of Orientalism
more,
than
yes.
This movie is. Yes, but similar in the sense that this movie is a movie that takes place in India and concerns Indian people, but it's not about those people, right? The Indians in this movie are purely symbolic. They're purely metaphorical to tell the story of these nuns and their relationship with their own feelings, right? And so like this is an Orientalist text in the sense that like it's using a people and a culture to make this sort of broad symbolic point. My problem with it is that symbolic point is really well made in this movie. And like this movie is extremely well constructed, right? In doing what it's doing. I think that, I really love the haunted house aspect of this movie and the vividness that you were, discussing, Jason. It's interesting that the author didn't like it. I guess maybe for the author who was, maybe interested in something subtler, I could see that, but I think it works so well as this. I think this is a very audacious movie in a lot of ways. It's a surprising movie, right? Like in how we talked about how much of the movie is innuendo, right? Like I was continuously sort of taken aback by how bold it is in what it's doing. And so I really love the like, the bluntness of the symbolism that like these women just went to a different part of the world and are so unequipped to deal with the feelings of being out and about in the actual world and interacting with people, that it becomes mystical to them, right? That they have to like, they believe that this is some like wild magical place. And like Deborah Carr keeps talking about the fucking wind, like, oh, the wind did something to me. Like it's turning me into somebody I'm not. It's like reawakening these old memories. And it's like, I love the juxtaposition, right? Like just, that the idea that like these people and their culture, their way of life is so hilariously sort of ill-equipped for reality that they have to ascribe mysticism to a place that is just another part of the world, right? And it's for that reason, right? That like it's interesting, right? Because like yes, like Orientalism often does this thing where it's like, puts this weird sort of like weight mysticism on othered cultures, but it works in this context because like that is what these nuns are doing, right? And we are seeing it from their perspective, where it's like, oh, like there is a sense in which like we never saw India in this movie, right? We never saw these people. We saw these nuns interpreting these people, and in the nuns' minds, This is what the movie is doing, right? Like in the nuns' minds, like there are all of these vibrant colors and these ridiculous things happening because that's how they are processing what's happening to them. And I think that
until it turns to shadows and
right, you know, exactly.
Until the final act of the film happens, right?
Right.
That's a great point.
So we're talking about how well constructed it is and how like it on any level, it's really beautiful to look at. Cody, you saw The Red Shoes with us at the trial on a couple of years ago, I think late 2022 maybe. And if I remember correctly, you gave it a pretty high score on Letterboxd. Honestly, I just want to toss to you because this seems like a movie that would be right up your alley, like all your shit of the most heightened, beautiful, you know, a direct vision of a thing, you know, alongside its sort of like darker tone and themes. It has like this incredibly beautiful, stark Gothic presentation. Did you come away from this with a similarly positive review? Excuse me, opinion?
Nope, it's bad.
Oh no!
Just kidding. Wouldn't that be wild though? So I saw. I'll just refute that all immediately. No, this is great. I saw Black Narcissus. As a tail end of a double feature, I actually had the pleasure of seeing A Matter of Life and Death coincidentally with, punk rock band Harry and the Mackens, Friday evening at the Trilon. And watching those two back to back, my first thought as like Black Narcissus booted up and we get the first couple sequences, I was like, man, cinematographer Jack Cardiff might be actually the greatest to ever
do it.
I know we flirt with director photography greatests on this podcast, but Jack Cardiff might actually be the one. But coming into this, yeah, and having that mileage with Red Shoes and Michael Powell's Peeping Tom as well, that is not technically an Archer's film because Powell was the only director. Pressburger was not in the mix as far as I can recall. But seeing how those films, they're not afraid to get close in on their actors. And that is something that really pulled me through kind of the early goings of this movie where it's rough stuff. Especially contrasting with A Matter of Life and Death, which is doing some different stuff, visually, at least right away. But the brown face, the weird sort of fits of Mr. Dean, which I guess in retrospect, framing them as like conscious fetish outfits almost makes that work, a lot better. The fits, it was his hat that really got to me. It was plus the one inch inseam shorts.
When the nun asks, like, wow, look at all of those feathers on your hat. Are they all from birds you shot? And he just goes, I don't shoot birds. And it's like, well, where'd the fucking feathers come from then, dude? Like, it bothered me so much that he never explained that.
Yeah. I think the haunted house sort of mechanic, as y'all have been characterizing super well, coming into this, some beats early on got me thinking really about The Shining, just in sort of like, smooth brain movie bro. Okay. I need to like find a lily pad to like hop on to just map this onto my brain and then like let the rest of my experience evolve from there. Definitely felt traces like structurally of a previous episode from forever ago, Sunshine as well, where it's something of a literal mission in this case. And then the last act devolves rather into something completely different as a result of everybody sort of mutating over the course of the previous runtime. But all that is to say, having the haunted house, having this environment as a sort of funnel through which to not necessarily 100% understand the madness from the perspective of these characters, but at least just understanding that it is there. And I think that allows the movie to do a lot of really like lean into the visually fascinating stuff that it's doing, everything with the matte paintings, the focus on like differences of scale. Human beings look really small in this movie most of the time, just framed against like big old fucking cliffs, all that good stuff. And then as we go, a lot of like the fulcrum for a lot of the action and like what I'm learning about the characters is done through those close up, just like looking at eyes darting back and forth, watching Deborah Kerr as Mother Superior or what have you, just like be wary of everybody dart, you know, this way or that, watching Mr. Dean and Sister Ruth eye each other through similarly, we're just cropping those fucking pearly, I was about to say pearly whites, but that's teeth, those beady eyes of everybody's. So I think on top of the sort of maximalization that the Archers seem to like to lean into the contrast between that and then when they actually get in close and they choose the right moments to do it too, as sort of like the explosive finale of a terse sequence, and just having the facial expressions, what the emoting do the bulk of the legwork. My neurons are really starting to fire now, but I think the short way to answer your question is, this matches my experience watching this matched my other, the other experiences I've had watching these dudes movies. I think it's a very sensible inclusion in that sort of maximalization canon.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you brought up like those specific shots, tight shots of faces and like the contrast between those and some wider shots. It happens a couple of times in this movie, but it's like a distinctly, and I'd say this baby's first movie podcast kind of thing, but it's giving me a distinctly 1970s vibe to some of these shots where there's, I'm thinking of two times in specific. There was, I forget which nun it is, but she's conferring with Mr. Dean in the foyer or whatever. And she, before leaving the scene, like exit stage left, she goes halfway up a staircase and then she whips around, realizing that Sister Clodagh is on the other staircase. You might be thinking of the exact same shot. And the camera just whoosh, switches immediately, pans very quickly and very deftly to Sister Clodagh. And it's like, oh, that was kind of a jump scare. No sound cue, no music or anything. Just boom, a quick zoom pan to Sister Clodagh. And then, you know, she's an intimidating figure. She sort of like chastises the sister for welcoming Mr. Dean because he's seen as this malintent force, whatever. And then there's another time where it's Joseph Anthony, I think his name is, the little interpreter boy who speaks English and helps teach English at the convent. It's when Sister Ruth is on her like real downswing. She's like, it's one of the last moments that she like sort of rejects the call, so to speak, to come back to the order, and Sister Clodagh is offering her some kind of clemency. She has Joseph Anthony bring a glass of milk to Sister Ruth, and she's just brooding and, you know, sitting there absolutely working up a storm in her habit. And he brings milk in, but it's like a shot sort of down from low with sunlight reflecting off the stone floor. Again, it sticks in the mind.
It's incredible.
It is beautiful, isn't it?
Yes, I know. You started and I was like, what scene is it? And I was like, yes, that scene when I was watching, I was like, holy shit, this looks good.
It really does. Just incredible. Again, it looks 25 years ahead of its time in terms of like the choice of place to put it and where they've staged the actor. Light is coming in from behind him and it's also reflecting. I mean, I'm getting kind of specific because I think that does, like, there's a certain revolutionary aspect here, a certain like mood that they wanted to put me in with all of those shots. And then as the movie goes on, it manipulates that with, toward the end, it like very quickly juxtaposes like, oh, you're staring down the bridge of your nose down a cliff as you're staring at a bell, you know, ringing back and forth and somebody's about to fall to their death. And juxtapose that with like very tight shots of sweaty faces and like crazed eyeballs. It just works its way up to this absolute fervor, this fury of
fever pitch, right?
It's crazy. And it does, like, it starts to make you feel like, oh, maybe the air in here in my, you know, home alone is fucking me up a little, because it's just like an emotional, a physical response to what's going on. And
breathe, right? It's crazy.
It was so fucking tense. And I don't know. It's just like, it's one thing that the movie includes those shots, but then I look back on them and I'm like, oh, that was intentional. I feel very like warmly and positively and like distinctly about some of these shots. And then toward the end, it manipulates that. It abuses that in a way to like put me in a very specific terrified mindset with things that like it had shown me before, just in new ways, like new outfits and new angles and stuff. I would call it like, this is my second Archers movie. Absolutely. Like it was mesmerizing. It's nuts.
I would say that I agree with your kind of general take about the way that the film was shot being feeling kind of ahead of its time. I also think that it also feels like it feels very of its time in a way that, like, it is, you know, this is a film that was, you know, the color processing was done with Technicolor, obviously, like, clearly, right? I think this, like, this movie kind of does not work without Technicolor, you know.
Yes, which is a thing that, like, super agree with that.
Right, like I don't know how much of this is intentional. Like, I think there's maybe a, when talking about this kind of stuff, I think there's maybe a way of like kind of pretending it's like kind of a coincidence or by accident or whatever. I think that, like, you know, the everyone who worked on this film was probably very aware of how Technicolor looked.
Oh, they were
like
locked the fuck in. Yeah.
Specifically in a film like this, or like obviously there's something like The Wizard of Oz, which is kind of doing a very similar thing in regard to its vibrant use
it's
of
also,
colors and whatnot.
Yeah, it's also worth noting that, like, Pal and Pressburger, that was like their whole thing, was like using Technicolor like nobody does, like, and really making it their own.
Let's pick movies in which that, like, eccentric use of color is, like, the point and, like, helps that.
Let's put it in the title.
Get, like, driven home. Right. And so, like, I think that, like, yeah, I think that, like, the, you know, the kind of the staging and the blocking is, like, yes, feels ahead of its time, right? I think that, like, the use of color feels very of a time that is, like, I think, like, more than pretty much any movie, like, watching this, I was like, man, I would love to see Technicolor. I know, you know, it's not gonna happen, right? But like, I would love to see movies that look this kind of vibrant again, because I think that, like, specifically with a movie like this, it's the technique and the style there is something that, like, is so important to what this film is doing with its characters and kind of its plot that, like, I don't know, it's kind of it comes together in an incredible way, I think.
Yeah, it's almost like there was a time when directors understood that, like, making movies in the visual medium meant that they had to use the tools of the visual medium to tell their story in a unique and fascinating way. Otherwise, there was no reason to do it as a movie, as opposed to something like a book. Yeah, no, I super agree with that point. I also watched this movie right after A Matter of Life and Death, which was a really great informative experience, right? Because I think that, like, it, having seen three Powell and Pressburger movies now, this, Matter of Life and Death and The Red Shoes, you can sort of see some patterns start to emerge where it's like, it's not just the use of Technicolor. It's just this, like, wild inventive creativity that is somehow sort of like reverent in its irreverence. And I know that doesn't mean anything, so I'll explain what I mean, which is just that, like, it feels like these guys are fearless, right? Like, they have no sort of like allegiance to a style of filmmaking. This especially was apparent to me in A Matter of Life and Death, which does absolutely wild, ridiculous things, right? There's a switch in the beginning of the second act in A Matter of Life and Death where they switch from black and white to Technicolor, and then one of the characters says one is starved for Technicolor up there. And, like, literally just calling it out for the audience. And there was an old person in the crowd at the trial, and they literally cheered at that line. And it was like, I get it, right? And that sort of, like, almost like boldness, that, like, body irreverence for tradition and style, it really translates throughout all of their movies, right? Like, I was shocked how ahead of its time this movie felt, not only in terms of filmmaking techniques, but also in terms of, like, commentary. Like, I think that, like, this is, like, it's literally not even a post-colonial movie in the sense that, like, as the Wikipedia says, like, this movie came out right when India was declaring its independence from Great Britain. And it's this incredible, like, incredibly nuanced take on colonialism and on imperialism that is also, like, extremely funny and extremely, like, sort of like taking the piss out of it, right? Like, I think that this movie, despite, like, and maybe this is the bigotry of low expectations, right? Because you think of old movies and you think, oh, they're going to be a little bit stodgy, they're going to be a little bit, like, stuck up or a little bit tense, right, or terse. And it's like, no, this movie's hilarious. It's, like, so vibrant, it's so funny. Like we said, it's, like, full of innuendos. It's, like, basically an extended joke about nuns at the heart of it. It's, like, this really, like, holy shit, like these women be horny, but, like, elevated to, like, the highest art form without losing the fact that it is also that, right? Like, I think with Powell and Pressburger, there is this, like, really fascinating conflation of low and high art into the same thing. Like, they find this meeting place for it in cinema where they can be funny and they can be irreverent and they can be experimental and creative, all the while producing, like, some of the objectively best movies of all time, in the sense that, like, you know, like, even somebody that like you would think would hate something like this would end up loving it, right? Like, it, because it's just undeniable that they were that good. And I think that, like, it's so fascinating to me that like these people that are so venerated in the canon of filmmaking were making movies like this, right? That feel so radical and inventive and sort of like silly in some ways. And I was really like taken aback and impressed by that, as I have been with all of their movies, right? Like even The Red Shoes does a lot of that stuff, right? But especially this one, and it just the idea that like, we're going to make a movie about how like actually colonialism was about the worst people in the world, bringing their repression to other places and then projecting it on, the world. And that's why we think of like exoticism the way we do today. And it's like, that's one, a great point, two, a hilarious point, and three, like you needed both of those things to make that point, right? Like this is a profound point about imperialism, but it's also a funny thing that you have to say in a funny way. And I yeah. love that for that.
It's, I mean, this movie widely is sort of has been received as like, oh, it's this control versus desire. It's, you know, the inside versus the outside of the convent. And I think that the very, because of like the tactics they use to get there, because of like the style, because of that like line it rides, you say, between being like sort of, we'll say for lack of a better term, fun and fetishizing, so to speak, and like really high-minded and thoughtful, low and high, so to speak. It rides, it like navigates that uncomfortable space of, you could definitely easily read this as, like we were saying earlier, that haunted house, like it's right. the world getting to them thing. But I think it's way more like, about it, like lampooning, so to speak, the control side of that, the like they're right. forcing assimilation. They are there on behalf of a local, you know, tribal leader, who is presumably, I mean, it's not particularly known, but presumably funding like a method of further controlling the people at, you know, in the village, through a new form of religion.
Well, it's mentioned, you know, that he's paying the townspeople to like attend, you know, the right. hospital and whatnot, because they usually wouldn't do to like local customs and whatnot. So yeah, mm-hmm. he is doing this and like, as like a way to kind of further his own kind of, you know, domain over, the lands that he controls and whatnot.
Right. And it's like, I guess I see it as more what is the term I'm thinking of? Like, it's looking more at the intent of the nuns, like the reasons they're there, than it is like, oh, the ways that they're being sort of like changed or affected by the place itself. It's only what they've brought, so to speak, that's really like leading them to this point of madness throughout the movie.
Right.
I think that's like
to a hilarious extent, right?
Exactly.
To the point where the movie continually points out how ridiculous it is that they are projecting their interiorities out and blaming them on the external nature of the world around them, right?
Right.
It's like they brought all their horniness and their repression and their ridiculousness with them from the mainland, right? From the empire. And they're going to blame it on everybody else because of course they are, right?
Right.
And that's just the whole story of empire writ large, encapsulated in this one place.
Yeah. And it gets there through jokes about sausages, you know, I think is the fun of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, sorry, go ahead, Aaron.
Just like the thing that I think is like very, very interesting about this that I think can like be maybe a little easy to overstate because this movie is not like some sort of like perfect critique of that sort of stuff, as like,
right,
I think
very much not
like focused on these sort of subjects is like going to have those problems, you know, and this film like has other problems than that too, which we'll
there's a whole lot of talk about, right? about the people that live on the Himalayas as like children, right? That is not really addressed.
That is probably true to life to the British people in the region, unfortunately. That is probably how they talked about the villagers. I think that, like, you know, the interesting thing here is that, like, you know, they talk so much about like the nature of, you know, the kind of the local townsfolk and like the, you know, the, of course, the wind being so clear, the ability to, you know, see the mountains from anywhere that you are, like that sort of like, like hyper intensity of life, like kind of, you know, reflecting back at them and then causing them, you know, all these tensions and whatnot. I think like the interesting thing is that, like, you know, apart from some, you know, admittedly like kind of racist depictions of the Indian people, I think that for the most part, the people that we see are really not like overly exotic. It is rather that the people that we see in kind of the, you know, the cloister or the group of nuns or whatever are overly repressed and overly, you know, kind of conservative, right?
Yes, that juxtaposition is so important to the movie, right? Like, the people are just people. Like, they're yes. pretty normal.
Everything seems like fucking Technicolor if you only wear white right. all day, right?
Well, the nuns yes. are like aliens. There's the pull quote. Right? It's like, that's the point, right? Is that, like, we're prepared to, like, be like, oh, like, we are on the side of the nuns. They are the normal ones. We're going to go out into yes. this wild land. And then you see it through the looking glass, and it's like, oh, wait, no, like, that's true. Nuns are, like, weird yeah. fucking alien
they're,
cultists.
They're coming while fucking ringing bells because it's such a stimulating rhythmic activity. You know what I mean? Like, it's... It, and that's
they
my,
describe
that's
they
my,
describe men walking into the room as the world in the thrust in behind him. Nonsense.
Yes. Like I, you know, I think this is a case of, like, you know, the Technicolor and the use of the backgrounds and the kind of heightened reality aspects of you know, the shots and whatnot. I think that is a case of it reflecting not the truth of the world, but the truth of how these people see the world based on, you know, their context within it. Right. Where I think, like, even something in it, it's done throughout, like, pretty much all of the visual metaphors in this film. But I think, like, so even something as simple as, you know, this palace, like, precariously perched on top of this mountain, right. Like, so high up, but so close to this, like, descent into this valley, right. With, like, these shots of, you know, ringing the bell and then just, like, this giant valley, you know, underneath you, like, streams running through. I think that, like, that precarious nature, you know, of the structure of that building is, like, such just a fucking simple and obvious, but, like, really effective metaphor yes. for the, like, mental and, like, mind state that these characters are in. And, well, like,
And also criticisms. Yeah, sorry, go ahead. But, like, characteristically was, also yeah. kind of funny, right? Because it's like even the character points out, right? Mr. Dean points out that, like, oh, nobody should live up there. Everybody who actually lives in this region lives down in the valley, because living up in a mountain isolated from everything is really stupid. And there's building a palace up there is really stupid.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, of course the nuns are going to choose that, right? They're going to choose this ridiculous, isolated place where they're like, it's epic for them or whatever, right? And he's just like,
well, it's reflective of their theology,
doing?
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
They're literally, like, above looking down on these people, right? That sort of stuff is so good in this movie. Yeah, we're like, they choose to be up there. I think, like, another aspect, someone has mentioned, like, the kind of the haunted house, like, kind of ghost story version of this. I think that, like, one theme that I'm, like, very interested in, that's, like, generally, like, kind of a postmodern theme, but is reflected in, like, you know, films and books and whatnot from this time, is, like, the idea of, like, a ghost story without ghosts, right? Like, being haunted by something that, like, doesn't actually have a presence. And I think, like, the thing, or, like, one of the things in this movie is, you know, the fact that this, like, palace used to clearly be what was a harem, right, in the past. Like the you know, this kind of old ruler used to have his like, all of his women there. And it's like, yeah, we know what's going on in this fucking palace, right? And, like, that fact is, like, sitting in the back of, like, all these nuns' heads the entire time this movie is going on. I think that, like, you know, they are haunted by like, the understanding that they're, like, occupying a place that used to have a different purpose, that is, like,
and then the sluttiest man of all time keeps coming up the mountain and, like, aggressively, like, chopping wood and doing manly
always
plumbing,
standing with, like, one leg perched exactly. up on something. It's like, what are you doing, you pervert? Get out of there. Like, I'm not on the nun's side, but, like, have a read the fucking room, dude. You know, although he is reading the room, he understands that they are all super horny for him. You know, good for him.
Honestly, good for him.
I was a little thrown by.
We could probably talk about him as well. I mean, I don't know if that's a good discussion topic, but
he's talk a little bit about Mr. Dean. I was confused because, Aaron, you left your hand up for, like, maybe the 1,000th time on this podcast.
I'll take it.
You want me to? Just fun fact.
He usually
listener,
goes down.
I'm always, the one to drop, put it down myself, just like that. I can put it
Wait,
down.
Really?
Yep. Wow. Every time.
Can I put other people's down? I can't.
No. Well, I mean, I can't put them up. I can put them down.
I'll make a point about Mr. Dean. I think Mr. Dean is, like, seen as, he is Mr. Dean, right? Mr. Dean. You know, he is, they make the point that, like, Mr. Dean is like one end of a spectrum that exists for these people, right? We're like, the holy man is like on one end of the spectrum. There's this kind of speech given. The holy man is on one end of the spectrum as a person who completely immerses himself in the nature of the world around him to like the, you know, kind of the shutting out of everything else, right? He is one with nature. He is sitting on the mountain, not just nature, but like higher nature, higher reality, and like does not, as far as we can tell, kind of talk, eat, do anything else, right? He sits there and he is in the world around him, not even necessarily observing the world around him, but is in the world around him 100%. Like Mr. Dean is like the opposite of this, and that like he is not concerned with any of that. And so like he's on this other end of the spectrum. And like the thing that like, at least the thing that I'm kind of reading into this is like, I think Mr. Dean very much kind of acts as a counterweight to the kind of the Orientalism in this film, right? Where like these nuns view these kind of Indian townsfolk and the people there as these kind of other beings that they cannot connect with, do not connect with. And like their presence like brings this great deal of tension to them. But I think that like they're also, they also have kind of the same reaction to Mr. Dean, right? And that like Mr. Dean is somewhat representative of just like a guy. Like, yes, he is a exaggerated, attractive, young male version of a guy, but he's like a guy, right?
To the point where like they keep talking about how he is like this existential threat to them, right? Like he's like, oh, he's not a good man. Like, be careful for
Mr. Fixing the plumbing.
And everybody's like, what are you talking about? Yeah, exactly. It's like literally they're like, you're not allowed to touch the plumbing. You're not allowed to, you know, lay those pipes, if you will.
He says, I'm only here for the pipe, I assure you, while he's cleaning
right,
it.
And like,
fucking,
God damn it. There's so many that like, honestly, you don't pick up on to like, sorry to like, that's so obvious in hindsight, but like that and the sausages, I just fucking totally whiffed on.
We gotta have a whole section here about our favorite innuendos, but your point about, right, but like, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say that, like, we see them react to, you know, these, like, the people in Asia and, like, come off, like, you know, horrified and confused and whatnot. But, like, they would have the exact same reaction if they walked into, like, an Irish or a British pub.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So like, you think Mr. Dean is important for that, right? Like, we need him here to show that the nuns' reactions to Orientalism are not indicative of how we as the audience should be reacting to the depiction.
They are
of,
not.
Yeah.
Yes. They are not just indicative of a reaction to another culture. They're a kind of a symptom of a larger problem that is the kind of repressed, like insular nature of this religious order is what I would say.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point.
Yeah. And I think to that point of the counterbalancing of what they come to realize about themselves through Mr. Dean or what they refuse to, I think it's important that Mr. Dean is the one who introduces them to to the holy man who doesn't speak, who's just sort of starving himself out on the cliff. If I interpreted this correctly, it seems like quite a turn for that character to actually be. So he's the uncle of the local, I'm not exactly sure of the term, but of the local leader that calls them.
The general, the Raja.
Yeah. He actually has or had an incredible amount of money. Apparently he was like a very wealthy man. I'm reading from the subtitles here. He has several foreign decorations. He lent the general money to buy the place. Nobody's ever heard him talk. And in that moment, like it's not very well commented on. He's just like hinted at through cinematography and through like distinct shots, very close up shots of his face focusing on the distance. But it's like, that is an element that they sort of lose an excuse of the Orientalism of like seeing the people of the village as completely other, completely different, below, beneath, when they learn that, and they don't comment on it probably pointedly, when they learn that that man who is probably the most like outside of their own sphere, type of person, he lives a life that they cannot, that they, you know, sort of don't imagine or can't like, maybe they're, now that I'm saying it, maybe they're like, they've idealized that idea of you know, self-reflection and servitude and stuff and dedication to one's, vocation, but, they have like no commonality with him, so to speak. Like if they have degrees of commonality with the people of this area of the mountains where they're living now, they see him as like sort of outside of it because he doesn't communicate, because he's not proselytizing, because he's not evangelizing his faith. And yet he has like, he is very much, it seems like he was part of the British Empire at one point, gave it up, you know, instead gave his nephew money to buy the place so that he could bring in people, and then just sort of like divorced himself from the world. And in that, I think the nuns are seeing another degree of that counterbalance that Mr. Dean himself represents, where if you're othering entirely groups from here, you must see a little bit of yourself in some of these people. You are also part of Empire. He is somehow also part of Empire and dealing with it in a different way, or like presenting it in a different way. As Aaron calls him in the chat, he's just vibing, but he is, but like it's what you're not seeing of that character, what Dean, Mr. Dean reveals to them, that sort of like adds color to that character and then to the nuns' interactions with him over the course of the movie, such as they are.
Yes. Okay. So I think that's very well said, very well described, except that is what the audience is getting from that character. I would argue that, except for maybe at the end of the movie, maybe the two main nuns, the nuns don't get that, right? Because mm-hmm. like what the nuns actually get is exactly the opposite, which is the really funny part about this movie, is that it presents repression as this like perfect mechanism for the transmutation of one lesson into the wrong lesson, right? Where it's like, no matter how clear it is what's happening to us, right? To the point where literally the sort of haunted house nature of this place is that it's too clear, right? It's like, oh, the water is too good. The flowers are too vibrant and pretty. You can see too far and too clearly across the mountain, and it makes you think things. And like there's a literal like multiple scenes where she's like, just work harder and sweep the floor harder so you don't think and you don't have sense experiences, because that's the danger. Right. And it's like, that's the perfect sort of like metaphor for like imperial repression that this movie is doing. Right. Is that like, it to us, it's so clear what's happening here, right? But like, it's exactly as clear in the inverse to the nuns, right? Like, to them, no matter like how like blunderingly obvious, bluntly obvious the metaphors, the visual metaphors in this movie are, to us, they mean the opposite thing to the nuns, right? Like no matter okay. how repressed they become, that is how like oriental the other becomes, because all they have to do is externalize their internal repression over and over again forever, to the point where like, you know, like you could see a 5-hour version of this movie where literally like the people don't look like humans anymore, right? Because it's like, that's, they literally drive themselves to madness because they refuse to accept and continue to apply their repression mechanism to the world around them, to the point where it becomes supernatural. And when in reality, it's just them applying their own repression to it, to its logical mm-hmm. end, right? Or its fantastic end.
Yeah, I think it's the New York Times review. I'll link whatever I managed to read that pointed out the nuns move from Calcutta, again, not, you know, places where they're from, so to speak, but just a place where it was easier for, and the quote was, that place had the suitable, climatic and social surroundings for them to enable like a certain religious zeal. They were successful in Calcutta. It's like where we start out the movie. And this place, Mapo or Mopu is, I was thinking Mapo Tofu. I'm hungry. Mopu is sort of like a, it is an other place within like already it's one far reach beyond their sort of comfort zone, so to speak. And according to the, you know, tenets of their faith, they should be very well prepared to go out and proselytize and evangelize. And what they face there is like, oh, well, you had sort of a created experience over in Calcutta that is not there when you visit this, you know, the further reaches of the Himalayas. And they think, oh, it's a new thing. It's attacking. It's sort of like, again, I think we're getting back to what Aaron was saying about it's less about coloring the environs as hostile, and more for the movie anyway, for the audience, coloring the characters as immovable, as forcing,
exactly,
attempting to force assimilation and, you know, externalizing, like you say, all of their internal repression and the things that they bring with them.
It's like, this is your mind on repression, the movie, right? It's like, hey, sure, like the reason why those British people went out into the colonies, the Empire, and like thought it was as scary as it was, wrote books like Heart of Darkness, is because of them. It's because of the fucked up shit that was in their brains, right? Mm-hmm. And like this movie is making that like very obvious.
Yeah, I think one of the ways it gets there, we sort of didn't talk about how the movie starts out, but one of the ways it gets there, and one of the things that I think is most effective about that, is that it has this very intentional sense of setting the scene. I thought of you, Cody, when I was watching the beginning of this movie, where we just have voiceover from Mr. Dean. Somebody's reading diegetically. He's reading the he's reading a letter that he sent to the convent, and he's just describing the place. He's talking about, I forget the woman's name, but the caretaker of the place. He's talking about how it's been abandoned. It's sort of like in ruins. He's describing why you shouldn't be there, essentially, in sort of begrudging terms. Was that an effective way to set up this story for you, Cody? Did you think back on how it sort of like, by the end of the movie and by the time that we find out the ways that these women are affecting and being affected by the place, did it sort of stick out to you as a way to, because I was thinking that it seemed a little bit on the nose for a movie to do that when we were going to be spending the whole time there anyway, but it felt like there was an intent to it by the time that we got to the end.
I liked the intent of it, and it went over well for me. And I think if it were framed any differently, I think it was literally right. A letter from Mr. Dean laying out the, just like, hey, this is what this place is all about. And they paired that with, and this is when I started thinking of, like, again, smooth brain film bro trying to like get into the weeds of this movie and just like find something to latch onto right away. Thinking about like The Shining of it all. We get a visual tour of the place accompanied by like Mr. Dean's sort of narration. It's not like we're getting this like not didactic reading, but just like this instructional sort of like, hey, this is a primer for like you understanding this environment before we even set foot in it. We do set foot in it as like the audience before the characters even see the place. And I think like melding the visual with that sort of instruction was, as opposed to just like reading this and it's just these two people in a room, like watching their reactions to the reading. I don't know if that would have been necessarily as valuable. Like it certainly could work, but I think it mapped onto like what my expectations for this movie were. And then that, like thinking about that, bookended with, kind of the jarring last, like, you know, last act, 20 minutes or so of this movie, which I know we're coming up on time, but I feel like that might be valuable to get into as well. I thought that sort of like that is the start. And then in retrospect, like thinking about where we end up, I don't know if people feel differently about that, but I think that's, yeah, as our way in, I thought that was, extremely valuable, especially we're like dipping our toes into the water, melding visual with the sort of just like this prose about the place we're going to. And then we get there, obviously, like the reality of it is completely different, or not completely different, but just like it gets skewered, in the eyes of our beloved nun protagonist. But, I thought all that works pretty well.
Yeah. Before, sorry, I know Harry, you had your hand up. I think it's just like what you're saying makes me think we see so much more of the interior of the place and we learn that place so much better like right off the bat. And so that we can watch the characters sort of unfold within it rather than we get a strong sense of their character or who they are. We get a strong sense of the place and like what it actually is, an objective look at, you know, the shape of it, the geography of it, the again, setting the scene there felt really important in a way I didn't expect it to before I
watched it. A version of that classic, like setting as character sort of trope. Or like the type of thing that we call it on this. I don't know if that's where you're going with it, Harry, but I wanted to just slide that in there.
Yeah, no, it's perfect because it's also deeply not an objective evaluation of the place, right? Like it super sets the stakes because Mr. Dean is himself also a product of British imperialism. Right, he's also a repressed dude. So he is giving us, literally narrating, training us to read the place the way the nuns are going to read it, by being like, yeah, like, listen, this is the type of place it is. It's this wild, like nothing, no Christianity can blossom here because it's too wild. Like you're too far into the dark, right? And like God isn't up here on the mountains, man. They've got stranger, older Hindu gods up here. And it's like, oh shit, you know? And then, you get there and it's like in a fucking House Hunters or whatever, when they go to a night market or something. It's like, wow, this is such a weird place. Look at how weird and crazy the culture is. And then the camera pans over and it's just like completely normal people sitting around like a picnic bench, like eating a hamburger or something. It's like, wait, what? It's like, that's what this whole movie is to me, right? It's that juxtaposition of just like these nuns being, and like it sets up. I really love the narration, especially in retrospect, because it like, it sets up this perfect sort of like, inversion machine that I was talking about, where like the repression is, he keeps describing this thing and he's trying to make it sound fantastic. And you can tell the nuns are salivating, right? Because it's like, oh, this is the perfect challenge. I'm the youngest Mother Superior ever. Nobody's ever had to take on something this challenging. He's giving us till the reins break. And like, it's all about how terrible and savage and uncultured this place is, when in reality, like, it's not. It's just a place, right? And like, I really love the ending of this movie that we can get into, because like, I don't necessarily think this is the point the movie is making, but I do kind of love the deconstructive idea that, like, even at the end, she's like, well, like, this is clearly proven that my faith is imperfect, because the place was just too powerful for me. So what I need is, I need to go back into training and perfect myself further so that I can confront something as terrible as the supernatural energies of this, this like palace that I came out of. And it's like, still completely missing the point, right? Still completely, externalizing everything that was interior and blaming it on this utterly exotified, like, bullshit story about the winds and the vibrancy and the sinister old gods that hide in the shadows of the mountain, right? And it's like, nah, man, like, that was all you, all the time.
Well, I mean, just to recap, since we're near the ending here, so Sister Ruth eventually goes mad with desire for Mr. Dean. She dons a red dress, puts on makeup. Sister Clodagh tries to prevent her from leaving the place and falls asleep, loses track of her. She runs away. She goes to Mr. Dean, who rejects her and says, go back to the convent. She, in a continuing fit of rage, in some really like striking, we've already talked about the cinematography, but like, she sort of skitters around the background a little bit as she's running away from Sister Clodagh.
She was like Toni Collette in fucking Hereditary. Yes. In the show.
Great makeup work too, like
yeah. She, unbelievable, she gets, looks like, at the end of this movie,
I am wearing a cute red dress. Oh my god, dude. I am a fucking possessed with like, yes, white face
I'm convinced.
With that last appearance she has, she looks like a fucking demon, man. It's so cool.
It's, I'm convinced that shot you're talking about, Harry, of her in the door frame as Sister Clodagh is ringing the bell, I'm convinced that like, they did a whole new makeup set for her rather than just like continuing what they had done before, because she looks dead already. It's crazy.
She does. And I hesitate to, in my mind, this is a junk drawer thought, but it's my only lead in for this movie really is, scroll like way back when the One Perfect Shot Twitter account was like at its apex, where it wasn't doing like shots to promote, like to peddle, like whatever movie write-ups it had on some website before it got like a TV show. It's just like someone or a group of people posting excellent dank ass shots from movies, usually good movies. And I was doing a late night Twitter scroll trying to get caught up on the world, and I followed the account, and it was just like 2 a.m. I come across that shot of Sister Ruth in the door frame, looking basically directly at the camera, humongous jump scare. So much so where I was like, and I know that I was like, this Twitter, like they do reposts every once in a while. I don't want this to happen again. I don't want to like unexpectedly come across Sister Ruth in my fucking feed.
And it's so terrifying, dude.
It is, so much so that I went in, I muted the phrase Black Narcissus from like my Twitter feed, just because they tweet out like the logistics of the movie. And I went back, it was like probably a couple months ago. And obviously the Twitter interface has undergone a lot of changes over the years, but I found like the muted words and phrases section. And sure enough, Black Narcissus still sitting there. And I, not that I follow that, the One Perfect Shot account anymore, really went downhill. But this podcast continues to go uphill. So, never worry. But that's all that is to say. Yeah. Like her being the center, like all of the externalized, maximalized, like makeup, wind blowing, lighting going so hard, framing, not getting afraid to get so close and crunched on people's faces. All of that coming through, and not for nothing, Kathleen Byron, like giving a great performance, and also her like facial construction playing so favorably into
incredible, like, man.
It's I haven't been this impressed by like a performance and like the visual framing of a character's performance in a long time.
Oh yeah,
it's immaculate. Yeah,
it's like
ahead.
They molded her face for this movie, right? It's like, how do you find somebody that looks like that and then put her in the movie? And I guess the answer is that I think Powell was dating her at the time, right? which is also hilarious. But like, yes, like, first of all, like, the fact that she understood the assignment as well as she did and is capable of generating the sort of iconic expressions that she generates in this movie. But like, even beyond that, just the casting, right? It's just like, hey, we need somebody that looks like a demon, like, come to life, is possessing this woman, right? It's like if Reagan and The Exorcist was achieved without any, like, well, not without makeup, but you know what I'm saying.
Right, yeah, I know what you mean. Prosthetics, yeah.
Right, and I also right. love that, like, I think that that character is so fantastic and such a great indictment of the continued failures of everybody involved. Like, just like Mr. Dean talking about how, like, the best he can muster, right, like, to answer for this is like, oh, I don't love anybody. It's crazy that you would feel that way. Whereas, like, everybody else, the nuns are all like, oh, well, she lost her mind. She clearly went insane because of the wind and the evil magics of the mountain. And it's like, it's so clearly not the case, but like, because of the knots that they've tied themselves up in ideologically and with their faith, like, this is the only way that they have to parse out the world. This is the only way they can explain what's happening to them. And it's farcical, right? Like, it's tragedy and farce all at once, because it's so clear what's happening to these people from our perspective, from a modern perspective, from the eyes of the people watching. But you know that they'll never figure it out, right? Like, she doesn't know what's happening to her. She thinks she's like been possessed by a mm-hmm. devil or something, right? And like, that's, and she's trying to take it out on the person. And it's like, there are two stories happening here, right? It's the story that we're watching, which is clearly what's actually happening, and the story as it exists in the minds of these nuns, right? And we're seeing them be like completely collided with one another. It's fascinating.
How do we read, you brought up the ending, of course, the Technicolor, beautiful greenery and everything in the background. We brought up the ending of where, Harry, you were saying that Sister Clodagh is now like, she sort of like rejects the reality of what's happened and is just sort of like soldiering on, oh, this was too rough a place for us, rather than, you know, we all went mad because of our shared repression and sort of like the trauma of being in the Catholic Church, so to speak. Do we read that she has, and by extension, the rest of the sisterhood, have they internalized like this new trauma? They repressed new things by which to be further fucked up later on by the end of this movie. Like, she's riding away, they're going back to Calcutta, they've quote unquote failed. And is it just sort of like continuing to feed that Catholic guilt machine for them? Is that she'll never be able to truly own up to, like, she could never truly own up to the reasons that she left, you know, that her loved one, the guy that she was going to marry, left. The reasons that Sister Clodagh is, we'll call her repressed, you know, big, you know, balloon term there. But do we think that she's adding new reasons and extension, the sisterhood? Do we think she's adding new things to repress as a result of this? You know, having seen one of her sisterhood die and several others be completely emotionally and physically destroyed by this experience?
So, yeah, I have it's a nuanced ending, I think. Like I said, I think that, like, there's that deconstructive reading, right? Where it's like, everybody absolutely rejects everything that happened. It's like, wow, it's such a shame. There was nothing to learn here. Let's move on to the next one, right? Like, and I think that, like, that is the sort of, like, punchline ending, that I think it is an aspect of this movie. That's not exactly how I read the ending, though, right? Like, I think that, like, they do something sadder and more nuanced, right? Which is that I think Sister, the Mother Superior, former Mother Superior, she understands, I think, what happened here. I think that ultimately, like, it subconsciously, even if she has to consciously reject it, like, she knows that, like, she's in love with Mr. Dean. Mr. Dean's in love with her. They got into this weird love triangle. Nobody was prepared for what happened. They were trying to be something that they weren't, because you can't actually repress human feelings out of people. It created this giant mess that ended in tragedy, and they have to move forward with their lives, so they're picking up the pieces. And I think that the movie ends on this note of sort of like, well, like, now she knows, at least on some level, right? That was her coming of age. That was her character arc. And, like, now we know as the audience, and we can take that with us, that, like, hey, like, this is, it's like a postmortem on the project of colonialism and why it failed. And, like, now we can see the reasons why it failed. And it was us. It was because we were trying to be something we weren't, because we were projecting our own failures and our own senses of inadequacy onto the world and trying to master it by, in the process, prove something about ourselves that wasn't true. I think that's how I interpret it. But like, in terms of like where these characters actually are, I do think that there is some sense of like that deconstructed punchline, right? Where she's like, well, I'm going to be censured. I'm going to be, I'm not going to be Mother Superior anymore. I'll be sent somewhere else, but that's what I need. Because like the world goes on, right? And like, there's this sense that like, this is it for us. Like, this is the only conclusion we can come to. Mr. Dean and the sister can't run off together, right? Like, they can't be happy together because they are still invested in their ideas of themselves as these people that are working on this thing. And it's never going to work out for them, but damn it, like, they're going to keep trying.
Yeah. And at the same time, there's at least my last note on the ending is my reading of the ending and of the rains falling at the end is like, there's a certain imminence to it all. There's a certain unavoidability to the ends that we've found here. Like, one of them literally died from her, you know, from repressing too much of what she was trying to avoid and what she was trying to run away from. And Sister Clodagh, again, I think like whether she's aware of it or not, she's now like internalized and repressed this new, I keep using the word trauma. I sound like Jamie Lee Curtis, trauma, rage and trauma, but she's internalized this now. She's not really admitting it to herself. She and Mr. Dean have that moment of like, they're speaking in front of it, so to speak,
that subconscious understanding that they're both repressing something. It's like, I see what happened here, and we're going to touch hands, but we're not going to talk about it.
Exactly. And she offers up her hand in a handshake, and he just like cups it from beneath. Like, we're both there.
Like,
lady.
Like, he's never shaken somebody's hand before in his life. That was also
crazy.
Hilarious.
It's crazy. But yeah, I see like the two things there are like, she is, knowingly repressing one more thing, probably the most traumatic thing that's ever happened to her, and two, that's only going to last so long, as did the repression of like that they already experienced and that led them to Mopu, is like, it will eventually crack. For Sister Ruth, it cracked. For almost every sister who experienced this thing, it cracked. Things
it's
went
inevitable.
Haywire.
I love that you use that word. Yeah.
And like the rains at the end, the final shot of the movie, the end, rain falling on, you know, the greenery at the base of the mountain. I just think it's like a really poetic ending to this movie. It like really brings that whole thing together. It's not a point of finality. It's like, oh, listen, you know where this ends. One of them is going to, either they're going to be like critically crippled by the repression over the course of their lives and live like half lives, or they're literally going to die from it some other way, is how I read that ending.
Right. And it's the perfect sort of culmination of the visual metaphor, right, as well, right? Because it's like, this is what repression is ultimately, is like, the more you repress something, the larger a part of your life it becomes, because the more you define yourself by what you're trying to reject, to the point where all that these people will have left is their repression. All that they will have left is what they're trying to reject. And it won't change what they actually want and who they actually are, but they will work themselves into such knots that they will have like a total negation of self, which is what we're arriving at the end of the movie. And like, I think that, like you said, there's this great inevitability to it that like, hey, like the project of repression is ultimately about self-destruction and self-negation, and that's all it will ever yield. Right. It's never going to work out for these people, but it is going to last forever because it's perfectly self-perpetuating in that way.
Pressure makes diamonds, though, Harry, I think is the message that it's trying to say. But then, of course, you have hydraulic
closer
press.
To thee, my God, you know,
you have hydraulic press videos that have like proven that you can also smash diamonds with enough pressure. I don't know if you guys have seen those on TikTok, but they're a lot of fun to just scatter everywhere. Any other thoughts on the ending of this movie before we get to our closing segments? And starting with the drawer. Any thoughts we didn't get to that don't qualify as junkies? Cool. Then I'll open up that drawer we all love so much. And Cody, you always have a rich fount of things to say. You already had some that were sneaking into the conversation itself. Rich fount. Do you have any junk drawer thoughts we can kick us off with?
I wasn't going to, but I guess this is like a decent sort of off-ramp for what we were just talking about, even though it doesn't play directly into that conversation. And apologies if I blacked out and this was brought up during the pegs or somewhere else, but I was just looking at The speaking of a fount of knowledge and information, the Wikipedia page for this movie, and just like a really cool thing to at least just the author of Black Narcissus, Rumor Garden, she described like one piece of inspiration for this movie, being she was exploring the Indian countryside with friends. They found a gravestone, cleared away some brush, and the name on the gravestone was Sister Ruth. Just like thinking about that and like retrofitting this, I don't know, just like thinking about the
rules so much, dude.
That's so cool. I don't know. Again, not like a don't need to read into it too much, but just seeing the name Sister Ruth on a gravestone and like unfolding this narrative thread is a cool thing to think about.
It's like when you were a little kid and you would like go on a hiking trip with your family and you would like see a sign or something out in the woods and you and your sister or whatever would like tell a cool story about it just to like stoke your imaginations. But then what your story was Black Narcissus, and you went on to create like one of the best movies ever made out of just that. And it's like, fuck, like it's so rad.
Folks, I know this is screaming into the fucking void here. It's not going to do anything. I will urge my co-hosts and anybody listening, if you like this movie, if you like the vibe, the tone, the themes, all of that, please read The Name of the Rose. It's so good. It's doing everything this movie is doing, but frankly better. It's one of the best books ever written. It's incredible. There's also a movie, but it's not. It's good to watch after you read it, but don't start with it.
It's weird. I was an English major. I've read a lot of books. I don't feel any sort of like compulsion to
proselytize.
No, I'm going to read. I was going to say to proselytize about all the books I've read. I don't need
to
make
about all the books. It's a book that's the same vibe. It's about a bunch of fucking Franciscan monks up in the mountains.
You should read The Name of the Rose.
The repression of their society. It's incredible. It is Black Narcissus coded. You please read that book. It's so good. Yeah. Continue.
I was going to put it like I did put it on my reading list after I saw you had positively reviewed it on Goodreads. So you're a tastemaker already.
I think that a bunch of I am not religious. I'm not kind of even interested in it at all, really. But the theme of a bunch of like a religious order, you know, just like up in the mountains somewhere having to face their own shortcomings. That's one of the great themes in fiction in my
Hell
mind.
Hell yeah. True. Absolutely.
Yes. Yes.
No arguments here. I could probably fix them though. Mr. Dean didn't have the juice. Did not have the juice.
Could fix their plumbing.
Which
Jason
would
have smashed,
I didn't get
what he's saying. Jason would not have. That lady shows up in the red dress. He's like, all right.
Jason would have walked to the top of that fucking mountain with like a pepperoni pizza, or it'd have to be a sausage pizza because of the aforementioned
crumbled sausage.
Just whole sausages on top of the pizza, not cut up. You know what I mean? Right. Just giant
sausages
with
slices of pepperoni at one end. We did not get there because I completely forgot. But do we want to, as part of Junk Drawer, share a favorite innuendo? I mean, mine has to be when the general says, I know what they eat. They will eat sausages. And I say, I think it's funny. I'm doing an accent because it's a white guy playing the character who's doing a really stupid accent. So I'm making fun of that guy. Just so you know, I'm not canceled yet. He says sausages in a funny accent.
That's not his son. Because his son is played by an Indian.
No, it's not
actor.
His son. The actual
Sabu
general himself, the guy with the one lazy eye, who does the thing. It is egregious.
You got his son to be played by an Indian actor. Just like go one step further.
And
you know
it's
what
not
I mean?
Even, like it's a very small part. It's important to the plot, but like,
I know
it's a very small character. He has one scene and you could have easily gotten, even if your argument was like, oh, we didn't have the perfect casting. That guy only needs to be on screen for 25 seconds and say like seven lines.
The quick note about, who I believe is Esmond Knight, the older general who you said lazy eye. It looks like he may have actually either like damaged and or lost that eye in the war. Something about like the latter stages of his acting career, he was half blind. So like on top of everything else that's being done with makeup and everything else. I wonder how much of that was like meant to doll it up. I don't know that there was, I don't know, like one hat, he very asymmetrical. But yeah, I wanted to, I don't know why I felt like calling.
No,
Jason, that's not a lazy eye. He's fucking half blind, you monster.
You're canceling me even when I said I couldn't be, and you're bad for that. You're canceled for that.
Finds a way.
I appreciate it because I only saw his like Letterboxd listing entry, and I don't think it shows both of his eyes in that, or at least not clearly. So I don't know. Maybe the fella didn't really have it. I take back my aspersions about the racist brown face guy. One of the racist brown face guys in Black Narcissus.
There are multiple. Also, Gene Simmons,
girl. Yeah.
Gene Simmons doesn't even have any lines in this movie. She's completely silent the entire movie.
She doesn't speak at all.
No, she doesn't speak at all.
She screams a lot.
She screams.
She doesn't speak.
I guess she doesn't speak English, right?
Yeah, she doesn't speak but, like, English she clearly. Speak, but
maybe you should have her speak a different.
Yes,
language.
Have her right. speak a different. And also like. That character doesn't even have any lines is like, I get like a important quote unquote part of the movie in terms of like the frame story, but like maybe just like don't cast her in brown face since she literally doesn't even have any speaking lines, dude. Like did they just need a hot chick that bad in this movie that, and they needed her to be white that bad that they were just like, hey, we're just going to like insert this character into this movie.
One of my other favorite pieces of innuendo is, I think it's Sister Clodagh says, without discipline, we should all be like children. And it's like, again, a pretty charged line. And I think in response, Mr. Dean's like, don't you like children? Creepy undertones, but like, oh man, nobody can stop thinking about how horny they are. Even when they're talking about these, like bringing people into order, right? Like there's a certain, you need that real bad, don't you, ladies? It's inescapable, the tone of this movie. Do we want to fly through any other innuendo before we get to
This was my Letterboxd review. At one point, she talks about how the world thrusts in with him. She literally says that line, kind of the whole like log line of the movie, but also a hilarious innuendo.
I mentioned the bells before. I will tell a story that is one of my mother's favorite stories, which is going to an English class and reading some poem, and like everybody just in like high school, and she loves telling story, so I'll tell it for her. And everybody, you know, was just reading it as high school students, and the teacher was like, you know, this poem is about naughty stuff. It's a metaphor. It's a bunch of metaphors for sex, and everybody in the class is like, no. This is some fucking Curtains of Blue Facebook post from 2013 bullshit. Like, there's nothing about sex. And then later my mom was like, yeah, I read it like 10 years later. And it's just like trains going in and out of tunnels. Just like, you know, sausages and fucking rhythmically pulling on bells. And it's just like the most horny poem of all time. That just like an entire, the most horny people in the world, high school students, just completely missing it. Just complete inability to see, you know, that Mr. Dean's cleaning out the plumbing.
They're too horny to pick up on the fact that
yes,
it's a horny poem. It's a beautiful recursive
way to characterize it. Yes.
which is exactly how you get people like what I was saying with the soft bigotry of low expectations, exactly. Where it's like you think that like old movies are going to be like boring, right? It's just like when you're in high school and everybody's like, oh, Shakespeare, he's so proper. And it's like, bro, like Shakespeare is just dick jokes. The whole, like, I know that this is like almost meme lord shit, right? But like, it is true. Like, all of Shakespeare is so funny and like so vibrant and so irreverent. And like, that's true of like almost all literature, right? Like, there are boring old bits of literature, but they're generally not the stuff that has stood the test of time. Like, the stuff that stands the test of time is stuff like this, right? Where it's like, you might think if you are forced to watch this at 15 in an English class that it's like some old dusty movie, but it's actually basically an extended dick joke.
It's juicy.
People were horny back then too, turns out. Maybe even more just due to the repressed nature of society, which
right.
is maybe it. Yeah. Not totally, but more repressed.
You could show a medieval peasant Pornhub and it would he'd blow his mind, right?
Yeah.
And blows
something, all right.
Oh. Cody, did you share your favorite penis jokes and vagina jokes from this movie yet?
The plumbing stuff was, I think, the big one for me. I spent way too much time trying to map out, like, in my noties, like, writing out something. Like, there's a whole ecosystem of stuff you could say. Just as soon as you introduce the idea of Mr. Peen laying pipe or whatever the fuck else, clearing out, unclogging shit. Again, the let your imagination wander. That was the stuff of gold for me. Shout out to Mr. Peen.
Keep your imagination on a leash, but keep it well within the frame of, like, it's just a horny movie. Don't try to avoid it. Well, thank y'all for your junk drawer thoughts. Whoosh. To change the tone a little bit, I accept that the title of Other Loves We've Tried has now fully transitioned. In absence of me, in the last episode, Drop Dead Gorgeous featuring Drew Tannenbaum, check that out in the previous episodes of Try Love, has now transitioned into To All the Loves We've Tried Before. I didn't like the movie upon which I assume that we've based the title of this, To All the Boys I've Loved Before, I think was the one. We'll exceed its inspirations.
Jason, they're the greatest love stories of our time, for what it's worth.
Are they? But we only have one film that we've discussed from 1947, according to my backlog, and it's episode 46, Brute Force, an episode I wasn't actually on, with Nick Ransbottom. And not to change the tone of the conversation too much, but I do want to point out our friend Nick Ransbottom, former guest of the podcast, video game writer, a wonderful person overall. He is struggling with a battle with cystic fibrosis, and it's not going incredibly well. And he's established a GoFundMe, he and his loved ones, to try and help ease the burden of some of that treatment. It's a big number, and I see that they're a good portion of the way to it. But I just want to call that out once more. I will also share it on Twitter. You'll find it in the show notes.
That's a really good point, Jason. Please donate to that listener.
Absolutely. Friend of the podcast, a wonderful person. Please do check that out in the show notes and share it around. If you can't donate, all of those good CTAs that people usually attach to these, it's quite needed, and we'd appreciate any kind of support for that. So thank you so much for once again tuning into another edition of To All the Loves We've Tried Before, formerly the second edition of this segment. Nobody really likes it. We keep changing the name and everything, and nobody really contributes to it. Everybody just kind of like waits and responds and reacts and says, why did you even bring this up? So I'll just, I'll stop it there. I'll cut it off there. And we will actually lead into what we have as a final segment of the show. But I don't do that alone, of course. I have support. I have my brotherhood. I have Harry Mackin to.
Hey, wait a minute. Did you actually say the movies that we previously did?
Yes.
Did I just black that out? Oh, all right. I was. Yeah, oh, that's it. Brute Force. Great, great movie.
Was it?
Yeah.
I wasn't on that episode, so.
It's a good movie, Jason. You should see that movie. The final segment that we would like to do is called
Cody's Noties.
Jesus Christ, what an intro. Thank you. I don't know if you could hear it. I was grinning ear to ear that whole time. However, I think this might have to be, if Jason poo-poos that segment one more time, I think I'm going to have to hold the noties hostage is what we're going to have to do. Just going to gatekeep it. Sorry.
We'll be at like
not happening this week.
Hour 1, minute 11, and you'll be like, listen, we need a 40-minute discussion about To All the Loves We Tried before we can get into Cody's Noties, and it'll be a 3-hour episode.
Might be, or it might just be a 5-second timestamp where I go, oops, no noties. It's like, well, thank you, Cody, for always ending the episodes worse than they started. but we'll power through today, just this once again. We're on the hot seat. Some of us are anyway. As our group of nuns sitting at the top of a fucking mountain somewhere, Black Narcissus showed us a group of people reacting to their environment, some successfully, some unsuccessfully, and some even experienced rapid changes to their character as a result of heightened scenarios, figuratively and literally. In honor of Black Narcissus, we will be indulging in a pack of narcissists. And yes, I will be reading the word in that way in order to make it work. By virtue of a lot of pulled muscles here, we're going to be hitting on some notable people or situations in fringe sectors of our culture. They may not be literal narcissists, but there will be a certain extreme nature to their circumstances. That is how I'm going to make this all work, and work it assuredly will. This will be a segment of the trivia variety. So one at a time, I will read off a trivia item related to someone or something from our pack of narcissists. I'll use the Spinner app to determine the answering order for each question. So it'll be random each time. Points will be awarded based on correctness of guess. Trivia Mafia rules apply. Use your noodles, not your Googles. With that, let's go ahead and jump in. We'll start with, I haven't actually been pronouncing the word this way the whole time. It's going to be a journey. We'll start with Stack Narcissist, a titan of the cup stacking world, one Chan King Ian from Malaysia. On May 19th, 2019, he became the legacy world record holder for what's called the cycle progression, which seems to be a stacking sequence that uses 12 cups. And from what I can tell, it is the type of cup stacking sequence that takes the longest to run through. But even so, Chan King Ian's legacy record time is a mere 4.753 seconds. Hopefully he's not a narcissist in the real world. I don't know him all that well. All that is to say, though, getting to the task at hand, my question for you all, how tall is one official sport stacking cup? That is the question that we have. How tall is a cup that is used, one cup used for sport cup stacking? And Harry is going to be our first guesser. Harry, how tall is one of those cups?
3 inches.
3 inches. All right. Locking Harry in for that guess. Moving down the line to Aaron. Aaron, how tall is one of those bad boys?
I'm just picturing a red Solo cup.
Do you want to stand up like you've done in previous
versions? Let me stand up just to picture a red cup on the ground.
You didn't need to have your balls out, man.
What do you mean?
Oh my God, he's got a gun.
I'm wearing a fucking robe. What are you talking about?
Yeah, it's open. Well,
what do you
the
mean?
Kimono is opened?
I got stuff underneath it. I'm not.
This is why you can't wear shorts.
Fucking, you're a pervert.
Black Narcissus, baby.
I'm going to go 5 inches.
Aaron's going to go 5 inches as he suggestively looks down at something. We're not sure what, but Jason, over to you for your guess. We have fun. Jason is also looking down. Guys, cups.
I'm going to say 5.25 inches. I feel like it's shorter than a usual Solo cup.
Why not just go 5.01? It's
a professional thing. Nobody's like, oh, it's about 5 inches. They would have a very specific. I'd be surprised if it's not more specific than that.
You're frankly probably measured in centimeters and it's all fucked. You know what I mean? It has no corresponding. Yeah.
I trust Cody to have converted, you know?
I would have, but the answer is in inches, and I appreciate y'all for doing this in inches. According to online sources, an official sports stacking cup, from what I can tell, is allegedly 3¾ inches tall. So Harry's the closest there by a couple fractions of an inch. So point for Harry. Next, we have Zach Narcissist. The Zach in question here is Zach Britton. we get to talk about baseball, y'all, who for a few years stretch was the best closer in Major League Baseball. For those unaware, the closer and more broadly, the relief pitcher role on a baseball team is a hugely volatile thing. You can't see it, listener, but I'm waving my hand back and forth to represent volatility. These pitchers are typically deployed during the most important and subsequently the most stressful times of a game. Mental fortitude is a must. It's often a position fueled by like good momentum that a pitcher has. Usually that momentum lasts for like a fraction of a season if they're lucky. So like being the best at that sort of thing for even a couple full seasons is like tremendously impressive. Because of all that, to be great at it, you need to strike the right balance of having a short memory for your mistakes. And then the rest of the time, just rocking this mindset of you're a fucking rock star. Nobody can touch your curveball. Nobody can hit your fastball. You're the fucking greatest air guitar playing. My question for you, Zach Narcissus, Zach Britton, what was the top speed of Zach Britton's fastball? What is the fastest that fucker threw a baseball? And first to the batter's box is Aaron. So Aaron, you're
really
facing down Zach Britton.
Yeah,
I was hoping it would be you too, for sure.
No, I was hoping it would be someone else first. I don't know much about baseball. I know that I don't know if I've ever seen the triple digit number for a fast. You know what? I bet though. I'm gonna go 118. I have no fucking idea. Yeah, 118 miles per hour. That's
118 miles an hour.
I mean, a fastball, like I know I've seen like I think 80s and 90s for pitches, but I don't know. I don't. 118 miles an hour. Fuck it, man.
Yeah, 118. I've got you locked in. The next guess will be provided by Jason. Jason, how fast was Zach Britton's top recorded pitch?
Well, his right arm is not an AK-47, so I'm not going to say it's 118 miles an hour. But I see where Aaron's going with it. And I, too, think that if we're really talking about a true narcissist, we're going for like triple digits anyway. I'm going like 101
miles. So we're nitpicking. We're nitpicking. Oh, okay. All right. Fuck you. Fuck you. Fuck you. Fuck everyone on this podcast.
101. When you write it out, it looks like LOL. Harry, what's your guess?
Well, I think Randy Johnson is like one of three baseball players who's ever thrown a fastball faster than 100 miles an hour. Maybe this guy is one of the other two, but I'm going to say 95 miles an hour.
95 miles per hour. Everybody here had shades of correctness, and everybody here was a little bit wrong, which is, hey, that's why we're here. We're here to learn.
To be wrong. We're here at,
nobody got it exactly correct. Jason was closest with 99 miles per hour is the actual. 101 was Jason's guess. So 99. Weirdly enough, Zach Britton had like a sinker that he threw was also really fast. So like his fastball didn't need to be like really fast because he had this sinker that was moving. You know what? We're just going to slide
that's
past
sick.
That.
So
point, do you think yeah, you're... Do you think you get really pissed if you hit the 99 and you're just like, motherfucker, that one more? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, you gotta be so, you know what I mean? It's like if you're 5'11 and a half, it's like, just fucking.
Honestly, yeah, probably. Like, I can't relate because I've been 6 foot for a long time.
And when Andy throws 105 mile an hour fastball.
Yeah, no, I throw 118, baby. You should see me at the state fair. I'm knocking over stacks of milk bottles, winning all sorts of stuff, teddy bears.
It's like that. It's like people. that one scene in The Rookie where he's throwing the baseball at the speedometer from the cop's car, and they're tracking it that way. I always thought that was a really good scene.
Yeah, yeah, an underrated baseball movie, The Rookie, and a properly rated segment as we so far, anyways. We move to our third, which is Yak Narcissist. So I stumbled upon something that I dearly wish we had more publicly available information on, at least stateside, and that's yak racing. Yak like the animal. And so what we do know is that yak racing is a spectator sport that takes place in Tibet, Kazakhstan, Mongolia, and other regions that hold, like similar flavors of like traditional cultural festivals as like a component of these gatherings that bring in dancing, music, decorations, and like flashy attire that the rider and the animal wear that's like symbolically significant to their culture, meant to attract good luck to the riders, that sort of thing. Seems to be comparable to horse racing in terms of setup and like space and also the risk involved. So I don't know, horse racing, you watch it from a distance, but I don't know, that shit's kind of scary. Horses
are yaks fast? Yeah, okay.
Harry, that is in fact the question. So I will say the winning yak and its rider basically just get bragging rights, but still I think being the best yak rider, even in a small like sample of people would be cool as hell. And to Harry's point, my question for y'all, what is the top speed of a yak? Just how saucy, how dangerous can this sort of thing get? And we'll throw it to Jason first for his guess. Jason, how fast can a yak go? Trying to think of something.
How fast could a yak fast if a yak could trek
that? There we, that fast. We got it. We're cooking.
I'm gonna go with 43 miles an hour. They seem like they're like too big to have a good start, but they're kind of like Wario in Mario Kart 64, where once you get him going, his top speed can reach bigger, like higher than
for sure.
Toad.
They
for
also
example.
Throw bananas at other.
Oh, you mean
yaks
tinier Dingo after. Dial from Crash Team Racing, same concept. Mm.
I'll leave my
maybe
camera
a little
for that
bit
one.
More, understandable for most folks.
Cranky Kong from Diddy Kong. I didn't play Diddy Kong Racing.
Oh, good I track, did. Wow. Honestly, actually, I should have left my camera on for all three of those. You know what? We're racing. The next, we should just pivot to racing games. Jason is not going to ask that question again. But I got your guess locked in, Jason, and we'll head to Aaron for his guess. How fast can Diddy Kong go? What's the top speed of a yak, rather? Apologies.
I think yak racing is like my favorite mini game from Shenmue 3. You know, that is the definitely little mountain village at the start.
How
of the
about
game.
A game of yak racing?
I'm going to say yaks are slower. Yaks are slow, but more maybe deliberate creatures. And maybe that's the exciting
like
part of the sport or whatever. I'm going to go 36 miles per hour.
36 miles per hour. All right. Gotcha down. And Harry, over to you. The last guess for this question. How fast do you think yaks go?
You know, I popped off about knowing more about baseball than my opponents in the last question came back to haunt me. I'm not going to make any mistakes. What did Aaron say? 36?
36.
I'm doing 35 miles an hour.
35 miles an hour. We are nothing but humble podcasters. Yaks, similarly humble, as they can only run at speeds reportedly up to 25 miles an hour, which cosmic balance of the universe, the axes adjust, and Harry gets the point for that question.
Pick up the slack, to rectify past yaks.
That's you what know, I'm saying.
It doesn't sound that impressive, but I bet watching Yak run at 25 miles an hour would be the coolest shit I've ever seen in my life.
It's got to be hype. Yeah.
I bet it would rock
yaks
so hard,
yaks aren't supposed
dude.
To run, right? Aren't the whole thing about
no,
yaks
like,
they just
they're
hang
like,
out where no one else can, except for like eagles, can fuck with them?
But they're beasts of burden, right? Like they can, they're like pack animals. Yeah.
It'd be yeah, like watching Bob Hoskins run a 500 meter. Like, he's not supposed to do that, but...
Bob Hoskins is the yak of men.
You've seen him with his shirt off, right?
It's a very good point, honestly.
Bob Hoskins is the yak of men. Clip that, TBH, as we head to our fourth member of the pack, and that is Mac Narcissist, as in McDonald's. Ray Kroc, I hope I'm saying that right. He's a businessman with a somewhat colorful, brash, maybe even crude reputation. He's like an all-time famous businessman. He eventually came to own the McDonald's enterprise. I'm sure that whole journey is laid out perfectly in the movie The Founder, that biopic starring Michael Keaton as the titular founder. But for the purposes of oversimplifying and keeping this under 2 hours, Kroc bought the McDonald's company from the McDonald brothers in 1961. My question for you, how much money did he acquire McDonald's for? Again, in 1961 dollars. That is the question. And the first guess will be provided by Harry. So Harry, what do you think?
Oh God, what day or what was the year that
what
he bought
it? 1961.
1961. $4 million.
Right. $4 million is the guess. Got you locked in as we head to our second guess, which will come from Aaron Grossman. Aaron, what you think?
14 pennies purchased. No, 50. I'm going to say like super small. I was going to say 50,000, but now Harry's guess is 50,000 seems absurd. $100,000.
Right. $100,000. Doll hairs.
Aaron, please consider I have no idea what the fuck I'm talking about.
Look, it's... You know? Who knows?
It's what?
Me too.
Jason, you've got the last guess for this round. What do you think? How much did he spend?
So I know Ray Kroc is the guy who franchised the McDonald's brand to shit. He's the one who put him on the highways and everything. He wasn't obviously the originator, but like I know that it blew up in a huge way after him. I'm going to say Harry said 4 mil.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say $9 million. I'm just assuming that he bought high and just went higher as all capitalists do.
Gotcha. We are nothing but humble capitalists. No, we're not. We're just trying to make it through. We're just a group of guys trying their best. As was Ray Kroc, as he bought McDonald's in 1961 for $2.7 million. $2.7 million.
Not bad.
In today's money, that's about $70 quadrillion. No, it's $28 million. Which still seems on the lower end. I don't know anything about anything.
I mean,
but that's
how many. Wasn't the whole thing as he just saw the kind of the business structure of like making them fresh right there really quick, and then he like yeah. How much value
stole,
was there actually?
He stole it
apart
all
from
White Castle. Look this up. They did it first. They did the quick service. Prepared
yeah, you're eating fucking
first.
White Castle, buddy. That's
yeah,
the,
I mean,
the fucking
like it wasn't
difference.
Better. But it was
White
first.
Castle rules.
White Castle don't have McChickens. That's all I'm saying.
Ain't got yeah, the well, McChickens. Is all I'm saying.
Oh God, this is too slippery of a slope. Boy, I don't want to be here for five more hours. R.I.P. the White Castle in Uptown by my place. It hasn't been a thing for a while, but pouring one out. And we're about to pour one out for this segment, but we've got one more question. Quick look at the scores shows us Harry has a lead with 3 points. Jason with one. Aaron's still yet to get on the board. Can happily say it is still very much anybody's game. For our final question, I propose to you Gak Narcissist. Gak is a term linked to the TV station Nickelodeon. I think it was like a Play-Doh-esque product that they sold. So that's going to be our inroad, our way to propel us into Nicktoon territory. So in the interest of the most extreme, right, the top of the tops, the peak of the figurative mountain, I want us to consider the most watched things in Nickelodeon's history. Some of us here are more Nickelodeon guys than the rest of us. And to that I say, it's just how it goes. I'm going to list four television programs that had some of the most watched episode premieres in the history of the network. And what I'm going to ask each of y'all to do is attempt to rank them in order of most to fewest viewers for their most viewed episode premiere. And I want to reiterate, this is not me asking which one of these programs is the most watched show overall in the history. It's just going to be the premiere, the singular premiere that was highest. You know, volatility, you know, the rapid whiplash of things, narcissism, it all makes sense. So I'm going to list the four programs, and then I'll give the rest of the logistics here. So the four programs you will be ranking are as follows. We have The Fairly Odd Parents. We have the Nickelodeon Kids' Choice Awards. We have SpongeBob SquarePants. And we have Rugrats. So those are the four programs. Again, you're ranking how watched, how the most watched, the fewest watched, their highest premiere. And so you're going to get a point for each correctly slotted program. There are going to be four programs in the mix, as I said. So if you get the order perfectly correct, for those listening who may not, you don't quite get this yet, if they get the order perfectly correct, they'll get 4 points. They can get up to 4 points. If they get two of them slotted in the correct spaces, they'll get 2 points. If none of it's right, they won't get any points this round, and that's just how it goes. So again, the four programs that will be getting ranked in our fine gentleman's perceptions of the most, highest audience watched, getting bogged down in my words, but like the most watched premiere to the least watched premiere of like the most viewed episode: Fairly Odd Parents, Nickelodeon Kids Choice Awards, SpongeBob SquarePants, Rugrats. And I'll spin the wheel, and I'll use that as an opportunity to check in with y'all to make sure I've given you enough time. I've got Harry first. Harry, have I vamped enough? Do you have a ranking for me?
Not a confident one, but I do have one. Yeah.
Sure. All right. Fair enough. Go for it.
I'm going to go, starting from the top. SpongeBob at number one, the Kids' Choice Awards at number two, Fairly Odd Parents at number three, and Rugrats at number four.
Gotcha. And I'm just going to read those back to make sure — this may seem inane to people listening, especially if I get it right — but just to make sure that my brain is in proper order today. I've only had 80% of a cup of coffee. But we got SpongeBob SquarePants, Nickelodeon Kids' Choice Awards, Fairly Odd Parents, and Rugrats. Did I hear you correctly?
Yep, that's right. Thank you.
Gotcha. Okay, perfect. And over to, well, we'll find that out yet. I haven't spun the wheel. So our next guest is going to come from Aaron, our resident Mr. Nickelodeon himself. Aaron, what's your ranking?
As someone who's not a Nickelodeon kid, quick plea, are you sure you don't want to change this question to a 10-point question about how much Avatar 2 made at the global box office?
Because that maybe next
great
time.
For me? Okay, all right, it's fine. Here's what I'm going to do. Firing from the hip here, I'm going to go number one, Kids' Choice Awards. Number two, Rugrats. Number three, SpongeBob. And number four, Fairly Odd Parents. That's Kids' Choice Awards, Rugrats, SpongeBob, Fairly Odd Parents.
Gotcha. Kids' Choice Awards, Rugrats, SpongeBob.
Kids' Choice Awards, the slime.
Fairly Odd Parents. It's Nickelodeon. There's slime
everywhere.
I feel
confident. Yeah. That's
right. Aaron's feeling confident, folks. But okay, perfect. So I've got that in. And over to Jason for our final guess of the game. Where do these sit for you?
I'm going to go with number one, SpongeBob SquarePants. Number two, Fairly Odd Parents. Number three, Rugrats. And number four, the Nickelodeon Kids' Choice Awards. All I'm going to say is, like, I knew mine was going to be influenced mostly by like exposure and nostalgia, what I remember. Yeah. And obviously SpongeBob SquarePants being like the most popular cartoon of all time or whatever it is. And then hearing that Aaron chose, Nick Kids' Choice Awards first is like, that's,
yeah,
that's because you
award
want
shows,
kids.
You know?
I mean, award shows happen once a year.
It's event television.
Right.
Listen to our other viewing recent podcast on this.
Yeah.
More information.
True. So that's my ranking. SpongeBob, Fairly Odd Peeb, Rug Beeb and Nick's Kids Choice Beeb.
Oh boy. So SpongeBob SquarePants, Fairly Odd Parents, Rugrats, and the Nickelodeon Kids Choice Awards. Gotcha down.
Thank you.
The tabulations. Yeah, the tabulations have been completed. The results are in. Just to get ahead of it, I will say thank you. This has been a pack of narcissists. I will now read the correct ranked order of these programs with regards to their highest or most watched premiere episodes, rather. And starting with number one, the top Nickelodeon episode premiere of all time, Event Television, with 11.9 million viewers, is Rugrats. For the episode, for the episode, All Grown Up. Do you guys fucking remember?
Oh, that's how I forgot. All Grown Up.
Wait a minute, but that's not Rugrats. That's Rugrats. Yes,
it is. Yes, it is. It was an episode of Rugrats first before it spun off. They were like 11.9 million viewers. We need to make this a show. And then they made it a show, and it wasn't nearly as good.
That's not an episode premiere.
July 21st, 2001.
Didn't you?
I misunderstood because it was misleading.
I feel a little bit bamboozled, but everybody else got bamboozled, so we'll call it like kind of an even bamboozling. Yeah.
Moving down the line to number two, it is number two on this list, and it is the number four Nickelodeon premiere of all time, and that comes from The Fairly Odd Parents for Fairly Odd Baby, because Cosmo and Wanda had a kid at some point. I didn't look too far into that, but February 18th, 2008, 8.8 million viewers. That's more viewers than I've ever had in my whole life. So that's something to consider.
You didn't mean premiere of shows. You. Okay. Yep. All right.
He pretty good. Clearly said episode premieres.
I thought that's what that fucking.
Not premiere episodes.
No, my bad. But like, yeah.
I also understood
my confusion. Okay.
Number three on this list and number five on the list of all time Nickelodeon episode premieres. This is, weirdly a blind spot for me. It's SpongeBob. It's for an episode Atlantis SquarePantis, which, like a TV appointment viewing, of course, November 12, 2007, 8.7 million viewers. I didn't want to go through the soul crushing process of reading a lot about this, but it did seem like a get was David Bowie was like a voice guest star of a character.
Maybe some parents were tuning in.
You know, back then, I mean, kids were going crazy. They fucking love Twin Peaks, Fight a Walk with Me.
I want to see the guy who was in that one scene of that movie.
They love the Berlin trilogy, but they thought he kind of fell off for Thin White Duke, but that was contentious.
And what
they get what he was going for artistically, but they disagreed with the way the message was delivered.
Right. Also potentially contentious. Number four on this list, Nickelodeon Kids Choice Awards. It's the number 12 premiere of the program or a program on this list, but it's the highest for Kids Choice Awards. 2009, March 28, 2009. Of course, it's pre-pandemic.
That's all some that staying stuff. Power. 7.7 million views. I would have assumed that their heyday was like early aughts, maybe, but 2009 was their highest?
I guess. Yeah. I mean, I don't like it. It got this looking into this got my neurons firing in a way that's largely going to be unproductive and I'm not going to think about it again. But it did get me thinking about like, you know, our golden age of Nickelodeon versus like what the actual golden age of Nickelodeon, how powerful like a TV episode gimmick can be when in relation to like, oh, this is, or we're summing up the whole fucking year of like shit that you loved. You shit eating kids, and it's not even cracking the top 10 of like all time. I don't know. It's wild to think about. Also wild to think about are maybe not that wild, but the final scores of this, everybody got on the board. Aaron picked up a point in the last round. Harry didn't get any in the last round, but he ended the game with three, which is tied with Jason, who picked up two in the last round. So sharing the pop off platform are Harry and Jason. I will let them have at it. Gentlemen, feel free to. You know, divvy up the time as you see fit, but the mic is yours to share.
Stronger together, all men are brothers, popping off our platform, poop. That's all I got.
That's more than I got.
Well, then I'll thank you both. Thank you all for participating in another edition of Cody's Noties. And thank you, Cody, for structuring. Your reaches are getting further, but the rewards, I feel like you haven't failed to deliver in the end. I I think that this is going to go in contention for the berries. This was a fun one, and not just because I share the pop-off platform, though maybe there's a commonality there. It's only March. Thank you so much for ending our episodes, as always, on a more fun note than they even started on. Hey, if you want to watch Black Narcissus, I think I watched it on HBO Max, maybe? I forget which service. It's on a few right now, including the Criterion Edition Collection stuff. But you've already missed it at the trial on. Sorry. Check out more movies by that John has programmed at the Trilon at Trilon.org and Trilon Cinema. They put out some cool stuff through both channels. Check out everything there. Check out Perisphere.org. There's a link in the show notes to a piece by one of their regular authors, edited by our own guest, Finn Odom. I will say we had Finn before Perisphere had Finn, but now Finn is guiding it as one of the managing editors. So check that out at Perisphere.org. Check out the Trilon's programming schedule, including Charlotte Rampling's Illusions of Invulnerability here at Trilon and the Heights in the spring 2024. At Trilon.org, you can find all that information there. As for this show, go back in the backlog, find a movie you've seen before, listen to us discuss it. We're probably embarrassed of anything before like episode 100 or so, but we'll leave them up anyway for posterity and to be eventually canceled during one of our political presidential runs later in our careers. I know it's going to happen statistically. We're four white guys who have a podcast. Check it all out at Trial of Podcast on Twitter. You can check out me on Twitter at Jason. God, not even at that. At Nintendoofus. I'm a little thrown. But I do want to redirect folks again to the GoFundMe link for Nick Ransbottom's life-saving cystic fibrosis care in the show notes. We'll also tweet it out so you can not miss it at all. Thank you so much for listening. Find us on all those links.
For sure. Yes, please donate if you can. And definitely watch Black Narcissus. Like Jason said, it's currently streaming on Max on Criterion Channel. And if you don't mind watching things with ads, because it means you get to watch the thing for free, it looks like it's also on Tubi and Freevee. And if you have a Roku device, that's on the Roku channel. So a lot of means of watching this dope narcissistic movie. Just kidding. Narcissus. We're Narcissus. I'm Cody Narvison. You can find me on Blue Sky at Cody Narvison and on Twitter at Cody_BH. Now on to our next Narcissus. Harry?
Thank you. I'm Harry Mack, and you can find me on Twitter at Punch Talking.
Folks, if you want to watch this movie for free without any ads, you can steal it off the internet. You should download a torrenting program.
Also, yes.
Yes, such as, you know, QTorrent. Go to like the Pirate Bay, for example, and you could just, it's a movie from 1947, folks. You just steal it. It's fine. They can't, no one's going to get you in trouble for that. If you like this and other hot tech tips, you can follow me on Twitter at RBPlease.
No, I won't be a nun. No, I cannot be a nun. Merry Christmas.